You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Welcome, everybody. It's Sunday, so that means it's the main course. We are broadcasting out of two shipping containers at 261 Moore Street in the back of Roberta's restaurant. We are going to have Shane Coffey is going to be our first guest. He's an old chef friend, a bacon maker, and a chef currently in the Turks and Caicos. We're also going to have Jessica Applestone, who is going to be a guest from Las Vegas. She's actually one of the butchers at the Cochon 555 event. She also had a book that just came out, and she's about to open a shop in Park Slope. She's going to be on, and then we're going to deal with the development coordinator of the Museum of Food and Drink. So it's going to be a really, really good show. I have my Katie is gone. Katie Kiefer is the beginning of her time away, although she will be here next week. So in her place, we have Mr. B. We have Jason Colucci.
Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone.
I always say of all the people who've ever come into this radio station to talk to, you know, my shows, you were in the top 250.
Thank you. So, I always thought it's because I get here on time.
But. Yeah. No, it's very good. So a big day. Amy Winehouse died yesterday. That was sad.
That was that was Winehouse, I think, when we came in, which is very off the cuff here. We never lead in with another. Usually we have our bluegrass kind of lead in.
Yeah, but we had Amy today. She was a real talent. I mean, you know, to be 27 and to be bordering on a household name.
Yeah, and then also if you really want to get into it and be a music geek, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and all died at 27.
Interesting.
And I think you can also throw Janis Joplin in there. All died at 27. Forever 27.
And then 33 was Jim Belushi and
Chris Farley.
Chris Farley, yeah.
That's it. They run on the SNL curve.
And
so
Jesus.
A little bit further.
Jesus was the other guy, most well known.
Okay. Are we talking about the King James New Testament or?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I don't know. I'm not sure. Okay. I'm really bad at religion.
Yeah, same here.
But our first guest in studio, off to a Yankee game after the show, so we're all very envious, is my old friend Shane Coffey. Welcome, Shane.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
We met first when you were the chef of Alias.
Yep.
A great restaurant on the Lower East Side. Then you moved to Colorado, where we continued to keep in touch,
yes.
And you somehow managed to get like a pallet of Heritage Foods in every now and then. And while you were there, you got into bacon production, which we're going to come to later. And now you moved to Turks and Caicos to work to be the chef for the Meridian Club.
That's very true.
So tell us a little bit about that hotel, and then I'm dying to know about kind of island culture and how a chef like you goes from New York to a place like Turks and Caicos, and how do you get that food and all that. So tell us a little bit about the hotel.
I'm the executive chef at the Meridian Club. It's on Pine Key, which is a 800-acre island about 7 or 8 miles from Provo. Uh-huh. And we service, there's 35 homeowners, and the hotel's about 14 or 15 rooms.
So there's only 35 homeowners on the whole island?
The whole island, just 35 homeowners.
Now, when you say homeowners, are these homes? Are these sprawling mansions?
No. They're actually, some of them are pretty nice, but okay. Think really maybe high-class Jersey Shore, sort of, you know, just...
Who are these 35 families?
Some of them are the actual Joneses.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Keeping up with the Joneses. just everybody's so down to earth. But I one time I'm sitting next to the guy and he's a billionaire, but you don't know it because everybody's just so just
understated.
Yeah,
it's every time it's. I have like an aunt or something that goes there. It's like, I'm going to Turks and Caicos. And then it was just like about 10 years ago, I heard that a lot for people going on party for weddings or something. And then it came more and more. But then I realized it's only a 3-hour flight away, which is interesting in terms of logistics for you, in terms of procurement. I don't know if that is you getting a lot of stuff from New York. I know you're buying stuff from Patrick, but in terms of produce and stuff.
Produce, most of it comes from Miami.
Miami.
By plane or boat?
By plane and boat. The one of the issues that we have down there is getting stuff cleared through customs.
Hmm.
You know, you'll just run out of orange juice. You know, and it's like,
well, which nation owns the Turks and Caicos?
It's part of the. It's a British overseas territory.
Okay, so are they as strict as they are in England? Like about food coming in? Is it the same? Like no dogs? Is it the same?
Oh no, yeah, it's pretty strict.
Yeah,
monitor everything. And you know, one time they wouldn't even tell us why we weren't getting, you know, oranges.
Do you guys have a like an expediter on the payroll or something at customs, just sort of somebody that knows their way around?
But the, you know, our food purveyor does
stuff like that.
So who are you in touch with, like for instance, how do lamb chops get to you? Because what is actually raised locally, talk a little bit about, I guess, the cuisine and the ingredients of local.
I can get some goat. It's the food that they do, it's a lot of oxtail, a lot of curried goat, fish, obviously. But it's interesting. They cook everything, I would say, to death. But, you know, that doesn't do it justice because it's so delicious. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't have air conditioning or, refrigeration 30 years ago.
Wow.
Right. So it's just a whole different culture when you look at stuff like that. You know, lots of pig.
Really?
Yeah.
Even without refrigeration, pork mm-hmm. became a part of the cuisine?
And amazingly enough, Spam didn't. But, mm-hmm. you know, lots of carnation milks, you know, lots of canned goods. And it's, as a chef from my background, that's a little hard to change that culture.
Mm-hmm.
But we're slowly getting there. I'm kind of showing them how that, you know, that tomato that you have on the island mm-hmm. is awesome, you know?
Yeah. Now, do you, can you order fresh? Like, if you say, I want this to be shipped by plane or I want this to be shipped by boat, and does the boat stuff come frozen?
I can get whatever I want. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of how long you're going to wait for it.
Yeah.
You know, I do the kale salad, you know, one of my little marquee salads, and it took 3 weeks to get our first shipment of kale.
Mm.
And it was like, really?
That's a long time.
It's a long time
for a salad to arrive. And is it difficult? I mean, to get access. I mean, you're really not sure. I mean, are your food costs different?
Oh, the food costs are crazy different.
So what does someone pay, or what do you?
Well, on top, just whatever you would pay here in New York, just automatically add 30%.
Wow.
Yeah,
and that's the transport of the product to get there,
mm-hmm. and then the tariff, you know, on top of that. So it's, and they just added another 4%.
Wow.
On top of that, yeah.
But you also work in a hotel environment, so the food costs are a little different than an independent restaurant.
Absolutely, yeah. City. And it's a unique situation. I'd never been in the hotel business before, and it was just interesting to kind of see, you know, the food costs that you can have at a hotel.
Yeah. In terms of just general waste, or just giving, educating all people a lot more about how to prep stuff differently?
My biggest... first thing I went down there to do was to reduce waste.
Yeah.
You know, because our restaurant really, it's not a loss leader, but it's not really a revenue producer either. And the only way to save money is to cut the waste. And we've done amazing. I mean, when I first went there, it was like trash cans full of food being thrown away. And I almost had a heart attack. And I was like, you know, it's a mortal sin to throw away food like this. And, but it was, they don't, because of, it goes back to refrigeration.
Mm-hmm.
Leftovers were a no-no.
Right.
You know, so
of course.
They just, it's cooked that day. It's not eaten, thrown away.
Now, do you have to deal with room service and every
not
aspect?
Really.
You're just the high-end restaurant there?
Yeah, I mean, I am responsible for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And we do have a staff lodge that is, we feed about 50 staff members every day, 3 times a day.
Wow. So you could trickle out a lot of the waste or the excess from the menu to those different avenues and things like that? Or does it have to be an original item?
The staff really likes their food,
yeah.
The local cuisine. I'm starting to get them into some more pastas and little... their local cuisine isn't the healthiest. You know, it's lots of salt. It's lots of butter and, you know, they need to change a little bit, you know, because some of them are starting to, you know, get high blood pressure.
So you haven't had to deal with any lack of quality. You can get Kobe. You could get.
I can get it.
Can you get something, for instance, like from if you had some lamb guy in Montana that you always liked? I mean, can everything get passed, or do they have to go through some like special test to get, you know, the English government?
As long as it meets the USDA requirements, mm-hmm. it's pretty much a go through. You know, it's just a matter of when it gets there, is the shipping container nothing contaminated? Something like that. So,
and are there parts of English culture in the Turks and Caicos, like the H&M sauce, like the brown sauce?
Or there's the brown sauce. There's, you know, the tea and biscuits, some malt, you know, chips.
Do you have to serve those things at your restaurant because it is an English outpost?
We do have in the middle of the day, we have cookies and tea and everything out. one of our guests, she's there like 6 months out of the year. Every day, 3 o'clock,
really
gets her tea and her.
You have
biscuits.
To cut all the crust off the white bread.
No, we don't do that.
Oh, you don't do that. Well, let's talk back now about meats, because I mean that's originally why we had you on. You are the developer of Rocky Mountain Bacon, which is whiskey barrel. Is that
whiskey? It's whiskey barrel smoked. It's from we get our whiskey barrels from Stranahan's Whiskey in Denver, Colorado.
Very interesting. So tell us how you develop a recipe for bacon, because it seemed, you know, how does one develop such a thing and then carry it out and test it and get its ingredients? I mean, tell us about the whole system.
We even got into it. How did you get into it in the first place? As well?
I really got into it basically through Patrick. When I was at Alias, you know, we started the heritage meats that they started, you know, throwing our direction. The quality was so great.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially the pork bellies. I mean, I remember doing the bacon really developed from a pork belly dish that we were doing, and just self-experimenting and playing around with it. And I was so interested in curing meats, and I was really interested in curing meats without the nitrates.
Mm-hmm. So what do you use as a substitute, like celery salt?
We don't use any of that either. It's pure, 100%. It's salt, it's sugar, and then the whiskey and the maple syrup.
So you developed the recipe at Alias, and what was existing in Colorado that allowed something like this to come to fruition?
The culture. It wasn't hard for them to eat bacon at night, because we would serve actually a bacon and egg dish.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
late night.
You know, big quarter-inch piece of bacon, you know, thick bacon on top of a fried egg. And it was there's a good interest in the cured meats.
Mm-hmm.
It's curious. Colorado was awesome because there's such a slow food movement, and just everybody's so into the local and sustainable systems there.
Huh.
What part were you actually operating out of? What part of Colorado were you in?
I was in Aspen.
Aspen. Okay. Yeah.
So, did meat ever get unsexy there the way it was in the rest of the country, or has Colorado always been kind of like a steak town, like Chicago?
It's a steak town. It's meat. It's lamb. Lots of beef. You know, the
processing the plants beef and stuff.
Yeah, it was hard for us to find actually a USDA certified pork producing place because it's such a beef culture. You know, way back in the cattle days. But and I'm a vegetarian, very vegetarian friendly chef. Mm-hmm. So it was a little weird for me actually that people just didn't even care.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm here in New York, and it was like, you know, the menu was veggie, 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 veggie. Yeah. People went for that. And then all of a sudden I get out to Colorado. Amazingly too, in Colorado, everybody wanted fish. And I was just like, that was curious to me too. Yeah, I'm like, what?
Well, I mean, that part, so you're working at that specific area, so people...
Yeah, we could get a lot of fresh fish out of there. But.
So is the popularity of meat today a backlash to the heavy vegetarian message of the 80s and 90s, you think?
I think it might be. I mean, there's definitely such a comeback for it. You know, I don't hate vegetarians. In fact, I support them a lot, very much so. Actually, most of my diet's vegetarian, aside from pork and bacon. Yeah, I'm the anti-Muslim. Is it a backlash? I don't know. I think people just missed it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's maybe something to do with, you know, just, you know, the economics of the time, you know, it's comforting to have, you know, meat in your belly.
Well, now I want to know, Jason, your opinion on this. What do you think of the new report from the Environmental Working Group, which says eating too much meat poses a significant health risk? Is that news to you, or do you agree with it? Or
I mean, I agree to everything in moderation. I mean, like you were saying, in terms of your staff eating a high salt diet and stuff like that, and high meat diet. I mean, if they can still have those avenues that they like to explore, but it can't be every day. Just
right.
Like you can't eat at Peter Luger's or whatever
right.
steakhouse you want to go to every day and have clarified butter poured over your steak and live that kind of a life. So. You know, it's...
But not that life, not Peter Luger's, but what about, you know, turkey sandwiches and a hamburger for dinner or the way the Argentinians eat? I mean, you know, a thin steak of grass-fed beef six times a week. I mean...
If you have a healthy lifestyle and stuff, but... And you sort of live that kind of in that kind of a world where you're just not sort of living a sedentary life, you can explore any sort of avenue, whether it's a vegetarian, a vegan, or beef, and you know, a little bit of genetics plays in that as well. But it's sort of the happiness that comes through that eating. You know, if you like that sort of lifestyle and you tend to be a happier person eating meat, then that'll come through, you know, physically as well.
I personally think a lot of it has to do with how the meat was raised. You know, obviously you believe in that too. But any sort of food, if it's been raised right, it's not going to be that bad for you, in moderation, of course.
So how many times do you eat meat a week out of, let's say, 21 meals? Do you eat 3 meals a day?
I'm 14. More of a tapas kind of a guy, like in the kitchen, just eating. I eat probably every day. I mean, every day I'll have pretty breakfast sausage at the restaurant and constantly picking. The first thing I do usually when I walk in the restaurant is I haven't eaten. Usually I don't eat after 8, but there'll be a sheet tray of breakfast sausage that goes on one of our dishes, and I'll eat that, and then it'll be 2 hours later there'll be meatballs there. I'll eat that, and so just constant tasting. So
what do you think about, do you think people are healthier if they eat out at good restaurants all the time, like Alias, or let's say you're one of those 35 homes and you come in 4 nights a week to the Meridian? Do you think you eat more healthy eating out, or do you think you eat healthier eating in? Because out, you get all these options for vegetables and herbs and fruits and things like this that you might not have at home. But on the other hand, there's more salt and oils and butters and all that.
I think a lot of people freak out if they saw how much salt chefs put in in food.
Yeah.
But it just makes it taste better. I definitely think you can eat healthy out. Mm-hmm. 100%. Yeah. And it's going to taste better just by the sheer nature. I mean, yes, there's awesome home chefs out there, but
Patrick, you're eating out a ton. I mean, I run into you.
Look at me. I'm a mess. I weigh 5'9", 320 pounds.
But I've run into you on 2 or 3 different occasions in the city, just walking
and
around.
And I'm like
and stuff
drunk.
Like
I have like a martini glass and a prosciutto sandwich.
I'm not gonna say where he's coming up, but you have to in your line of business. You have to eat out of your accounts, and
it's almost
your face.
An occupational hazard. I mean, really, because. Of course, if I go to Polino's and I'm like, oh, I just want to eat light, and Jason's there, I mean, I want to try the pizzas, I want to try, you know, one of the dishes, then Ann's also a big eater. So, I mean, together we're overeating almost all the time.
Right.
And we ate three at home 3 nights a week this week, and it was so unusual. And we were like, what do we do? And, you know, but it is dangerous, I think, to eat out that much. I mean,
it is.
I mean, over time, unless you're like you said, you're blessed with good genetics or something like that.
Well, you guys are the first couple of the slow food movement, so you have to show your face in all of the hot spots of New York City.
With the little waving hand. I don't know if the listeners can see, but I'm waving my hand like the queen. But now let's go back to this whole meat thing. Is there in the islands a kind of nose-to-tail food culture? Like, I want to see you bring in a whole pig or a whole cow and use it all? Because that's big, obviously, as you know, here in the States.
What we've started to do, we actually just, for one of our boat crews, it was his 35th birthday, we cooked a whole pig.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he's a Filipino, and they know how to cook pigs.
Yeah.
And they just got on the spit, you know, turned it, you know, 3 hours later, then we're mowing on some delicious, and they rub it in Sunkist.
Oh, really?
Yeah, an orange soda.
Oh,
cause,
man.
Because I didn't know
it's
if we had any.
American influence.
Well, I didn't know if we had any Sunkist. And I was like, because they asked me. I'm like, no, I don't know. I go, we got Coke. And they're like, oh, no, 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 no Coke. I'm like, well, next time it's Coke. Coke, American Coke.
That's why that ties into what you were just saying about the can culture and being on an island and stuff like that. Even though it's soda, it's just this, sort of that idea of having those products around. Mm-hmm. But the West Indian culture as well, they're all about whole animals.
Yep, absolutely.
As well. Yeah.
And now what about charcuterie? What are the rules for curing meats out there? And do you, do other chefs do it in the island?
It is exactly the same as it is in the States as far as if you're importing or exporting. It's the USDA. And just like here in New York, you can do whatever you want, you know, as long as nobody gets sick. And there's some of the French influences come up. There's a few chefs that will do it. But mostly... It's, I would say, of the chefs I know, maybe three actually are really committed to charcuterie. People are actually, when I got down there, there was a few chefs that were really excited that I was starting to do stuff more and make sausages and, do the bacon. It's not the same bacon, but it's a similar version of it that I started smoking bacon with coconut husks.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Yeah. Talking about getting products and not getting products, you kind of have to, you know, twist your view on things. And I never realized coconut was such a great smoking device, but it's awesome. It slow burns.
Yes. Interesting.
It's a nice mellow smoke.
Now, you're not trying to blow your diners away with creativity. Like, you're not pushing your envelope of creativity there, are you? Because don't they want consistent things, and it's about doing things that people know very well? Or are you kind of trying to push the envelope with the Turks and Caicos crowd, however you pronounce it.
My theory when I went down there was people just really want good food. Not going to blow them away with, you know, exotic ingredients or fancy cooking techniques. Mm. You know, it was just going to be good, simple food. And that's already my kind of mantra anyways, but I've even developed that even more, kind of focusing down and bringing down my style, I guess, with the way you'd say it.
How many meal periods do you have throughout
three.
The day? Yeah, and is there different sort of sections of the that maybe you do something different, or is it sort of just three specific meal periods? Like, you're not off, the restaurant's not doing something off-site?
Very rarely. Some of the homeowners will have us do some catering events here and there. We'll do some stuff on the other island if we're invited, you know, for food events and whatnot.
So what is the process? Give us just the headlines in this last segment of, you know, how you make this bacon and what is the process? How do you get the information? I mean, tell us really if someone is out there listening, they wanted to make bacon, like how do you go about doing it?
The best thing is to find some great bellies, obviously. I like the thick, you know, nice cuts that we procure from you guys.
Heritage Foods.
Heritage Foods USA. and then it's basically a 50-50 salt to sugar ratio.
In what? Just in a barrel? You put 50% salt, 50% sugar?
Mix it all
sugar?
Together, put it in a, you know, some sort of container and cover it. I will pack the pork bellies with about a quarter inch to a half inch of the mixture. And, you know, you can flavor it with whatever you want, you know, your secret ingredient. And then what we do with this one is we also add maple syrup to it.
Okay.
So it's cured with the maple syrup.
Which is not local to Colorado, right?
No, that's not local to Colorado.
It's just the Northeast, huh?
Yeah. And then it's about 7 days, and we'll rotate it. And it actually creates its own brine because the sugar and the salt pull all the water out. And we'll rotate it a few times. And for this product, the Whiskey Barrel Smoked Bacon, we add a touch of whiskey. Mm-hmm. And then we take it out of the cure, let it dry for a day, and then we smoke it.
Does it even have an alcoholic percent?
No, not at all. No. But I'll tell you what, though, when we pull it out of the brine, it's like a distillery, man. It's crazy.
And you had to find a USDA facility that was willing to work with you guys?
We did, and we found this great one, Homestead Meats in Delta, Colorado. And they're actually someone you guys should really look up and get into a relationship with. They've been awesome. They're big enough to handle our workload so far, but they're small enough to work with us because, you know, it was funny when we first went and contacted them. They were like, yeah, whatever. You're just blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then we started kind of moving forward with it. And, oh, you're shipping us a pallet of pork bellies?
Yeah,
we are. This is going to happen. And it was a long process to get the USDA approval.
And the navigation of going to a facility that already has it in their idea how to make bacon, and then you're coming and saying, we want it like this, use this recipe.
Fortunately, Dale Dexter, who's one of the main guys there, he'd worked for Coleman's, and he was in their research and development, and he was very, very excited when we started playing with not a traditional bacon.
Totally. And now it's going to be available, on heritagefoodsusa.com.
It is.
And are there other stores that carry it in Colorado?
Currently in Colorado, we are in the Butcher's Block in Aspen. We're in Roxy's, which is in Aspen. There's a boutique butcher in Snowmass right at the base of the mountain that carries it. Mm-hmm. City Market will carry our slab portion right now, and then you just get it cut.
That's awesome.
Whatever you want. And then hopefully by the end of September, I think we're supposed to maybe be in 5 city markets.
Very good.
Yeah, it's moving forward a lot. It's been a long process, but all of a sudden it's just coming. It's got its own legs.
Is it tough to balance both things, or are you at a point now where you sort of are able to do both because you're far away?
It is tough to balance both things. But, Zach Matthews, who's my partner, he's really the hands-on guy in Colorado, and he works his butt off, and he's driving here, driving there. He's sending stuff, and I'll get some weird idea in my head and Zach, I'm sorry to ruin your day, but can we try this? And but we have it's been a great experience and a good relationship because we've kind of done the 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. Yeah. And it's actually saved us, I think, a lot of money and heartache because we'll push forward, get the idea, but then we'll step back a little bit.
Yeah, I can see that. And it's funny you saying Coleman, they helped you out a little bit. Who's the company that...
Dale, who's the guy who runs our processing facility, he worked in their research and development. So he was really happy with that we were doing something not...
Something different.
You know, it's not Applewood smoked bacon. It's smoked with whiskey barrels. It's cured, uncured, really. We have to put on there.
And so how can people come and taste your delicious food? I mean, Heritage Foods USA for the bacon. Do you have a website for the bacon? I see the chef Shane's
online. Yeah, nice. And on our Facebook page is really the easiest way to get a hold of us right now, and it's probably the most fun.
Yeah.
Our web page right now is going to be just basically...
Just here.
Hey, here we are. Here's what we do. But the Facebook page is a lot of fun. It's very interactive. Mm-hmm. And it's the Rocky Mountain Bacon Company. And then we are on Twitter, which is and it's Rocky MTN Bacon.
Okay.
And nice.
Where your
short for mountain?
Where your seats at the Yankee game today?
We're right on the third baseline.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, down deep. I paid good money for these seats.
That's good. That's good. When you're in town, you got to do it right. Well, Shane, thanks so much for being on. It's always awesome. A pleasure. You're a very nice person in the food world, which is unusual, as Jason can attest.
So that West Indian sensibility.
Yeah, right.
Thanks so much. We are, by the way, engineered by Jack Inslee, broadcasting from Roberta's Restaurant. We'll be right back with Jessica Applestone from Fleischer.
Your rolled up sleeves and your skull t-shirt. You said, why did you do with him today? He'll sniff me out like I was decorated. Cause you're my fella, my guy. Hail me your Stella and fly. By the time I'm out the door, you're 10 men down like Roger Moore. I cheated myself like I knew I would. I told you I was trouble. You know that I'm now good. Upstairs in bed with my ex-boy. He's in no place, but I can't get joy. Thinking of you in the final throes. And this is when my buzzer goes. Outside to make your tips and pads up. You say, when we marry, cause you're not bitter, there'll be not of him no more. I cry for you on the kitchen floor. I cheated myself like I know I would. I'll show you how it's trouble. You know that I'm no good. Sweep reunion on Jamaica and Spain. We're like how we were again. I'm in the tub and you are the same. Lick your lips as I soap my feet. And then you notice a little coffee burn. My stomach drop, yeah, my guts churn. You shrunk, yeah, it's the worst. Too truly stuck the night at first. I cheated myself.
So we're back on the main course. It is Sunday, July something, and we are broadcasting out of Roberta's restaurant. My co-host is Jason Colucci today, and now we have Jessica Applestone on, is one half of Fleischer's grass-fed and organic meats, a now famous beacon to all wannabe butchers and all sustainable meat enthusiasts. She and her husband Joshua are the authors of the recently published Butcher's Guide to Well-Raised Meat, a new recipe book, Butcher's Guide, and overall encyclopedic guide to buying and cooking meat. They'll also be opening a store in Park Slope.
Very excited.
And they are right now doing a butcher demo in Las Vegas for the Cochon 555 finals. So welcome, hey. Jessica.
Thank you. You actually have Josh with us. We actually have Josh with us as well. So we're talking on a speakerphone from Las Vegas. So if we are not clear, just tell us.
Are there like little baby swans walking around, or tigers or cheetahs? Yeah. I mean, is it like I know Vegas to be from the movies?
It is just like that. I tweeted earlier that I think that Las Vegas is Spanish for boob jobs. It's really, I don't know about the baby swans, but there's certainly, there's a lot of high heels and a lot of blonde hair in this town.
Oh, brother. Well, tell us, why are you there in the first place?
We're here because of Cochon 555, which was started by Brady Lowe a couple of years ago, which celebrates, as I'm sure you know, heritage pigs. And so what we do here is that Josh does a demo, and he's going to be doing a demo, I think, later, earlier, and then Ryan Farr, who comes from San Francisco and is another butcher, is going to be doing one, as well as Amelia Posada and Erica Nakamura from Los Angeles. So we're representing the butchers. And then there's, I think, maybe 8 or 9 chefs here from all over the country who are serving up pork delights in every form and fashion to, I don't know, 800 to 1,000 people, I think, which is really insane. I know.
That's fantastic. So, Joshua, it's a pleasure to have you on. Do you cut the pig the same way every time when you do demos?
You do a riff.
It depends on what's going on. Usually with the demos, we try to correlate it with some type of dinner. So we have, I'm cutting kind of how the chef would like me to for that particular dinner. This is being done with, there's 2 or 3 large pigs for 10 chefs. So I'm working with 3 or 4 chefs at once on how to break the animal.
And what is the, I mean, traditional, like, where do things, I mean, certain things you do the same. I mean, what is, like, the biggest challenge, let's say? What part of the pig is the biggest challenge to butcher because of how many choices are available for how to do it, or just because of, like, a bone structure thing?
You know, really, it's not really a challenge. The only thing is whether you need to use a saw or not. When we're doing something like a porchetta, where you're just taking out the entire bone structure of the animal, you really don't need a saw. It's a lot easier. It's all done with a knife, like a 5-inch knife. When you're breaking down primals into particular parts, if you need to get through a rib cage or so, you really do need to use a saw. So that would be the only quote-unquote challenging part of it. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty standard. It's not a big deal. But really, what the whole trick is to slow down so you have enough time to fill in the allotment, like an hour, hour and a half, and discuss with people the whole time.
Well, there's that guy Dario, right, from Tuscany, that recites Dante's Inferno, and he ends it right.
Yes, he definitely does. Moment. Yes, he does.
He picked the longest
poetry.
He picked the longest poem of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So now we want to get into some bigger meat questions, but just tell us real quick, how the hell did you write a book? I mean, with how busy you guys are and how hard it is to write a book and just sit down and force yourself to write. Tell us a little bit about this exciting book and what it was like to write, and then basically the whole experience of it.
Well, the interesting thing is that we co-wrote it with a woman named Alexandra Zissou, who happens to be a customer of ours and is a great author. She's really well known in the sort of sustainable green community. She's written two other books, The Organic Pregnancy and The Conscious Kitchen. And so she came to us a while ago and she said, you know, I'd really love to write a book with you guys. And we dismissed it because we are really busy. And then she said, no, really, I think you guys should think about doing this. And so we sat down with her and she seemed like the perfect person, with the exception of she had no background in meat. So
was that good or bad?
Probably both.
That was an interesting hurdle to get through.
It was good in a large way, yeah, because you'd have to reprogram her.
So she was really open to everything, and we sort of started seeing things through her eyes, which was how our how the consumer or someone who was reading the book would see it too. So it gave us the perspective of someone who was coming to this all for the first time. So that was actually really beneficial. Josh was the one who sort of led the book and what he wanted to see in it. I did a lot of the writing, and Lexi did a lot of the writing. So he had very specific desires about what should be in a butchery book. And then, of course, our publishing house did as well. You know, there's a full lamb breakdown in that, in the book, literally from nose to tail, with pictures and descriptions of literally how you can break down a lamb on your kitchen table if you want to do such a thing. Mm. And I'm not sure that we would have included that, but our publishing house was really excited about that. So it was a very, very hard thing to write because butchery is so visual and so tactile. It really doesn't lend itself to writing about it.
Did you write it as a guide to butchering or as a guide to meat? I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, like how to purchase.
All of the above?
How to purchase.
Marketed more towards restaurant people or just. Or
yeah, because it seems.
This one we wanted for the home cook. If we were to do another one, we would want to do a more sustainable way of running a business, including whole animal butchery.
For restaurants.
For restaurants. The first one really is about trying to reach a very base level and to explain, you know, where we come from and just the basics.
That's great. I mean, and it ties totally into, which I'm really excited about because I'm a Park Slope native, about the new butcher shop, which is between Sackett and Union on Fifth Avenue.
Yes, it is.
right across the street from Beercroft. Can you guys, we'll get into that whole neighborhood and why it needs that and why this business will be extremely profitable and extremely busy. But can you guys talk about the genesis of why you picked that location and how did that come about? Because I remember I got a text message a few months ago about it and I was like, wow, that's awesome. So I literally live like three blocks away. Can you guys just talk about that a little bit?
I think I can talk about it a little bit and then I'll let Josh sort of fill in the rest. But I've wanted a shop in Park Slope for a really long time, and basically it's because I feel like Park Slope is our perfect demographic in a lot of ways.
And you guys have a child as well, right?
I mean, we do, so exactly.
So you fit in perfect.
Speaking of our demographic.
Yeah, it's pretty much our demographic, literally. You know, basically we're concerned parents who are concerned about what we would feed our child. We're, you know, we're New Yorkers at heart, and we believe that we seek out the best. And I think that's very true of Park Slope people as well, that they're educated, they're informed, they're trying to make the right choices. I think that's one of the reasons that the Park Slope Co-op has existed for as long as it has, you know, actively and well. I think that there's a real need in that neighborhood for this. And I think the other thing about Brooklyn is that people, and I guess this is true of Manhattan as well, but that people still shop on a daily basis, or at least a very, you know, bi-weekly basis or weekly basis, where they come into a shop or a butcher shop. It's not foreign to them.
Yeah.
And so
it's not like the boonies where you live, where people shop for the month or whatever. Yeah. No, just kidding.
Oh, God, I know. It's terrible. I mean, we are very lucky in our butcher shop. You know, people actually do come in weekly, but in general, you're right. It's amazing to me how much people
live in the boonies.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
That's okay. We like the boonies. You know, Las Vegas seems a little scary, actually. Yeah.
There's nothing boony about Las Vegas. There's nothing
more opposite than Las Vegas and Park Slope right now. But it's an interesting, definitely in terms of your surrounding area there. I mean, you have there's an old pork store down the block that's moved, that's right. Even further down. That's sort of, you know, very comforting, but sort of that old world feel of old New York feel of just come in and get something for cheap and then walk out. Are you guys going to primarily just sort of do retail and do a little education like you guys do upstate? Or
charcuterie?
Yeah.
We'll have all the same products we do upstate that we do down in Park Slope. We'll be doing all our processing down in Park Slope. Same way we do Kingston. We'll offer the same cooked foods in the freezer. As far as the educational with classes and stuff like that, we'll be getting into it. We really have to find our sea legs with how the city's going to run the store. So we want to, I mean, we're going to do it. It's just a matter of one step at a time. We'd really try not to bite off more than we can chew because we're so at the forefront of this and we don't like making mistakes. So
who's going to run the shop, or are you guys going to be spending a lot more time in the city?
I'm moving to the city three quarters of the time. Jessica and my son will be doing reverse weekenders, and we have a general manager that we've been training upstate, a gentleman named Jason Fox, who's absolutely amazing, that will be the general manager there.
Fantastic. Well, transitioning a little bit to some of the bigger issues behind what both you and I do, the American Meat Institute has just claimed, the Environmental Working Group says just came out with a big report that says eating too much meat poses a significant health risk. The American Meat Institute claims that the science for these claims are oversimplified. But I'd be happy to hear your opinions on, you know, whether or not meat is healthy and, you know, in what quantities and how you deal with meats in your diets.
You know, we talk about this all the time, and we talk about this a lot in the book. We basically are the people who are going to tell you that you're eating too much meat, and that's strange coming from butchers, but we really believe that Americans don't really know how to portion control, and that's a shame.
Or they're just not aware.
Yeah, that there's a lack of awareness. You know, and this is so true, especially in Vegas, you know, you walk into a restaurant and people have these enormous steaks on their plate that to us could feed two or three people, but that's, you know, a one serving for most of America. And I think that meat in the proper proportions is fantastic, and I think that you should eat less. I mean, our feeling, our philosophy is eat less meat, just eat better meat. I don't think you need to eat meat three times a day. I don't even think you need to eat meat, you know, five times a week. But I also, and this is my own personal thing, don't think that we need meatless Mondays. I don't think that there should be just one day that you don't eat meat and that you have to call attention to it in that way. I think that everybody should be eating a really balanced diet, and that means that eat vegetarian, eat meat, eat fish, eat, you know, whatever it is, but just eat in a healthy manner. You know, it always plagues me when I see reports that say meat is unhealthy, because I think that commercially raised, factory farmed meat is unhealthy, but I don't know that those reports always call attention to that.
Right.
Do you bring that up in the book at all, or is the book pretty much just a fact-based kind of thing, or do you guys talk about philosophy in your book at all, or is it half and half, or...
Our book is riddled with philosophy. I think it's pretty much our manifesto. We do bring that up, and we go over and over and over portion size and what we think people should be eating. I mean, it really is sort of our call to arms as far as that's concerned. I don't think that we could be more specific. And, I mean, it does sound strange, but, you know, it used to be so bad, and Josh had to stop me from doing this, but I would literally take meat away from people when they told me how much. You know, like they would say, oh, you know, I'd like four steaks, please. And I'd say, well, how many people are you serving? And they'd say four. And I was like, oh, you don't need to do that. That's just too much. You know, it's probably not the best way to grow your business. So he sort of stopped me from doing that. But we still counsel people all the time. You know, you really don't need to be serving that much meat. You know, serve more vegetables and have this as, as the centerpiece, but not your main source of food.
Now, what about the whole nose-to-tail movement, which obviously you guys do? I mean, is it a challenge to sell all the parts? I mean, I understand it's an important thing to try to do, but, you know, is it hard to sell trotters or pigtail or pig ears and really move the whole carcass, especially through, you know, a butcher shop or butcher shop combined with wholesale?
Yeah, it's been a whole steer, too, as well. You know?
Whole steers, yeah.
You know, to be very honest, in the beginning it was challenging. After 7 years, it's not really challenging. What's challenging is educating the masses on what we do. That we've hit a level where we have our head, we have all the headhunters, we have all the people who, you know, who we just basically preach to the choir that it's getting to that next level of getting everyday people who are not used to butcher shops to start using them, or how to start looking at things differently, and that's the challenge.
How do you do it?
We do cook products, we do dog food, we do stocks, we do soap, we do everything. Anything we can to make it more of an education for people about what could be done. And, you know, that's the challenge we find these days.
I think Josh was the first person, and this not make me sound a little ignorant, but this was a while back.
Don't worry about it. We know.
It's okay. I'm from Staten Island. It's okay. I think Josh was the first person to tell me the yield of one hanger steak per steer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Made me rethink every time I in a menu discussion.
You felt guilty then when you asked for 8 cases of hanger from your local farmer.
But every time now when we're planning a menu or something, I always bring that up. You know,
yeah.
It's not something that probably, you know, we're talking about restaurants that serve maybe 200 hanger dishes a day. So
yeah, it's a very, very popular dish. You know, it's just one of those things that it was one of those levels that we realized that once we brought that up, that really, really hit across lines that everyone has hanger steak on their menu and everyone loves a nice steak frite and. No one understands how unsustainable it is.
But it hits home to a lot of people because it's a pretty obvious thing. It's something people order. And when you talk about sort of more esoteric cuts and stuff like that, people like sort of shun and be like, oh, whatever. But something like that is a really concrete kind of a thing. Is there any other things like in that world and sort of that the cuts that have become more or less popular that you've noticed over the last few years?
You know, I'll tell you a quick story. When we first started out, our first 6 months, we were trying to understand how to do restaurant sales, and a friend of ours who owned a high-end cigar shop had brought us one of her clients. He ran some steakhouse. I don't know, it was in Vegas or New York or something. It was a big steakhouse, one we never heard of. And he's like, I just need number 16 and number 17. Like, what the hell are you talking about? He's talking about two steaks off of each side of the animal. That's all he wanted off the entire animal.
Oh, brother.
Yeah, it's a certain size porterhouse that he wanted. That's all he wanted. So it's like when you talk about the most unsustainable.
Yeah.
A restaurant that just takes two steaks out of an entire animal, that would be the most unsustainable thing I've ever heard of in my life. But that's standard, though.
Yeah. Well, whenever my chef friends go to Spain, they're like, I'm traveling to Spain. I'm like, oh, no, because I know they're going to come back and be like, we saw this new part. It's a new cut. It's just a 4-ounce section of the center of the shoulder. I'm like, oh, my God. But so
I realize that there are no new parts.
It's not like they grow different things.
Yeah, I know. It's so funny that there's still. I mean, yeah, I remember when I first started. I remember it was like a year. I mean, we started selling pigs in 2004, and then in 2005, I learned about the country rib. I was like, wow, what's been happening with that cut? There's still little surprises, but it is basically just the one pig. So since you're at the Cochon event, I thought I would just ask briefly in the last few minutes. It's about breeds and like what types of breeds you guys like working with and what are the most prolific breeds here in the New York area and just the whole kind of breed thing and the tastes and the culture around them.
You know, with the breeds, Brady likes using Gloucesters, Tams, Tamworth, Hampshires, Red Wattles, Mangalitsas, Berkshires, and there was something else I can't remember. But he does a whole different, and it's very interesting because what Brady does with the Cochon is that he really brings just a more of an awareness of how many different types of pigs out there, and you know the different things that you could be doing with these different types of animals as they all grow differently. As far as Fleischers is concerned, I really like using Duroc Burke crosses. I've moved into more Tam Longbelly whites because they seem to be doing better over the winter. They don't gain as much fat to muscle ratio, which is doing a lot better with the shop. Mm-hmm. We only, you know, it's funny, like, I don't do any more pure breeds. I stopped doing that a while ago because I felt that the genetic lines were getting messed up, that, you know, any successful butcher shop or restaurant really needs a big genetic pool to dip from, and we do better when we mix bigs.
That's smart. I mean, that totally makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting thing. I mean, because in a weird way, purebreds is a type of monoculture.
Yeah.
You know, you
it
could
is,
look at
it. And it's even funnier. It's like, when you start looking at dogs, you know, like, it's like, not to sound weird, it's, you know, when you look at mutts, mutts are much healthier than purebreds.
Yeah.
Because they just, you know, the genetic lines get mixed up and they don't have the same type of faults that run through the line. So
this is not to say that a purebred pig isn't a wonderful thing.
No,
there's nothing, purebred dog.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just like, you know, for what I need to do with the amount of farms I need to work with and the farmers I need to work with, it's easier. Because, and again, like, you know, we don't use vets. We don't use antibiotics or other stuff to animal gets sick or gets knocked down. So the ones that last are the better ones that, you know, that are just better for the farmer and better for the business.
Are you talking shit about my two Scottish terriers?
Actually, it's so funny. We have two pure breeds as well.
We don't have much.
We don't have much.
It's one of these funny things. But with pigs, it's better. But yeah.
So my final question is a question because I really have no idea what this means. But Katie was telling me, my usual co-host, not during the August period, is she says pork bellies are no longer traded on the commodity market. And she wrote,
is that true?
Yeah, no way.
That can't be.
No more railing against Wall Street for raising the prices of the pig. Will you miss that?
It.
Yeah, what does that mean that it's not going to... I mean, if that's indeed true, which I think it is, like, what does it mean that pork bellies are no longer traded on the commodity market?
Well, it's out of Chicago. It's the Chicago market, but, I mean, we don't...
I mean, I would say in a very weird sense that it could mean that our food chain is finally getting recognized as being a little bit unstable, and they're waiting to see if a more stable product to hit the market.
Are they deregulating it? Is that what it is? And they're just like, let the businesses...
Honestly, we don't follow the...
Yeah, me neither.
It's not the way we do things. So
we're probably... We have that in common.
It's been
since forever. Yeah, it's very important.
Yeah.
Pork belly.
1908 or something like that? Yeah, I mean, pork belly politics. What are they going to do about the whole phrase?
And it's the entire plot line of Trading Places, so we have to...
Yeah. It's so... Exactly.
Oh, God, you're showing your age. You realize that.
Yeah, that's awesome, though.
It's so funny that you guys and us, Heritage Foods, like, never deal with the commodity market. It's funny. We probably fall into 0.1 of 1% of the entire pig market that, like, doesn't
even...
Oh,
it's amazing, the numbers. The numbers are just staggering.
I know,
see it, like, when you look at the four top processors in this country, which I guess actually one of them isn't even in this country, but you look at the numbers and it's like you realize really what we're doing is just so small.
Yeah.
And I know it's very preliminary with New York code and everything like that, but do you guys have sort of a semi ETA on the Park Slope store that we can tell our
Jason's getting hungry.
Everyone.
I'm sick of going to Union Market.
No, don't do that.
Yeah.
So,
I've had great publicity lately.
Do you guys have an idea?
Great with the meat. September 1.
Awesome. Mazel tov.
Well, that's really great. I know how busy you guys are, so thanks for spending some time with us on a busy weekend. Do you guys want to drop some websites and stuff about Fleischer's and the new shop and where people can follow news and Facebook, Twitter, such?
Absolutely. We are www.fleischers.com, and that's FLEISHERS. And Twitter, we're Fleischers. And people can sign up for our email on our website, and we'll be announcing the opening and things like that, as well as probably on Twitter as well. And the book, finally, is called A Butcher's Guide, or The Butcher's Guide to Well-Raised Meat.
And all this stuff is available, you know, you can see it on the show tags for this week's show, and I love it. These guys come strong. They write an email every week, like Heritage.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like whenever they can think of something. Like, they're like, we're going to stay an active news force.
No, and it's always pretty, it's always pretty witty.
Yeah, it's very funny. It's well designed and all that. And you're involved in CSAs and stuff. Anyway, it's a great website to be involved in. So people should sign up. And thanks for giving us some time on an early Sunday morning in Vegas.
Thank you.
Not at all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We will be back with Sarah Pollack, the development coordinator for the Museum of Food and Drink.
He left no tact or regret. Tear up his dick wet. Wear his same old shape bag. Me and my head high. And my tears dry. Get on without my guy. You went back to what you know. So far removed from all that a week you went through. And I take a troubled track. My eyes are stacked. I go back to black. We only survive.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Hot Grease every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Hot Grease strives to bring sustainability, localized sourcing, and other forward-thinking schools of culinary thought to the minds and kitchens of everyday folk. Each week, Nicole Taylor's conversations cover the entire spectrum of food enthusiasts, from internationally renowned culinary masters to moms on a budget looking to impress their tiniest critics. Again, that's every Monday at 3:30 p.m., Hot Grease on the Heritage Radio Network.
Well, here we are back. We are sponsored by Hearst Ranch. We are broadcasting out of Roberta's. We are engineered by Jack Inslee. And now we had a little busy signal. I don't know if anyone heard that, but it's not there
anymore. But it was in Vegas. It was in Vegas, so that's so cool.
Yeah, it was a busy signal. The rest of our show. That was very interesting. And now we have a real mentor to millions of young children around the world, or soon to be. We have Sarah Pollack, who is the development coordinator for the very exciting Museum of Food and Drink. Welcome, Sarah.
Or MOFAD.
Yeah. Thank you.
I was saying, what if we change it to the Museum of Food and Gastronomy? but that would not sound very good. So who is behind MOFAD?
Well, it's not just me, obviously. But back in 2006, Dave Arnold, who does Cooking Issues...
On the Heritage Radio Network. He's also the technical...
He's the technology director at the French Culinary Institute. And he was working with his mentor, Michael Batterbury, at the time. And they sort of really were into the idea of doing a Museum of Food and Drink, something that would really have a home in New York City that would represent, a definitive educational resource for people coming to the city and wanting to learn about food, because obviously people are into food these days. And 5 years went by, and they didn't really get a chance to do anything. And I think when Michael passed away last summer, it really lit a spark under Dave and the new Patrick, I guess, like, sort of were cheerleading behind him and really, like, helping him, like, build that momentum. And in March of this year, held a fundraiser at Del Posto, and they were able to showcase different exhibits, potential exhibits for the museum, doing all these great chefs like Wiley Dufresne and David Chang and Mark Ladner doing different, like, one on fad diets, one on Native American diets, different potential exhibit, a way to showcase what we would be about, what we would be doing in the future, and then through that raise a bunch of money so that you could hire somebody like me to go through
pull
and
pull it all together.
Pull it all together. Go through and dot all the I's and cross all the T's.
So where are you guys at now in terms of opening the place and where
next Tuesday?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, do you guys have an idea? Because I mean, we're talking about a huge undertaking.
It is an enormous
financing and space and you know where do you put the Reuben Sandwich exhibit?
God, that would be amazing.
It's the second time we brought that up.
It is. It's very early on, very nascent stages, which is really exciting because it's like at this point the museum could be anything, and our imaginations like know no bounds. So this is a really exciting time, but it is definitely years down the road. Hopefully not too many years, but definitely years down the road before we'll be unlocking the door on the museum. But that doesn't mean that we're not doing anything right now. We've been in touch with a lot of different food luminaries around New York City and in touch with everybody around town, just sort of introducing ourselves and seeing like what they would be into and what they would want to see be in a food museum. And that's the kind of feedback I would love from anybody is like, what would you want to put in a food museum? What would you want to see? And so we're trying to build these partnerships around town, like the New Amsterdam Market. Robert LaValvo was really generous and offered us an opportunity to come down to the market and do an exhibit and talk about our plans for the future. Or the Mulberry Street branch of the New York Public Library had talked about doing a food demonstration. Like just getting the opportunity to have tastings, to do seminars, to do demos, a way to sort of showcase in a small, you know, bite, essentially, of like what we're planning for the future.
So you're looking for federal and private financing or both?
Yeah, I mean, right now it's, you know, we're facing the same challenges that any startup organization would do, whether it's a, you know, a .com or you know, a pizza restaurant. It's, you know, we just need an investment of people's time, of their money, of their energy. Right now, it's just sort of building to a tipping point, if you will, just anybody that is interested should get in touch with us. You can email me, you can call me.
Yeah.
And the idea would be to get enough people to really like carry our momentum forward, and hopefully we'll find that person or company or foundation that'll really want to invest in us and carry us to the finish line.
So you're shooting to be an NPO?
Yeah, we will be. We'll probably be a private museum, but a not-for-profit. So a membership-holding museum, people allowed to be members, and that'll gain them certain access. The same way that you would be for MoMA, the same way that you would be for
the Natch.
Yeah.
The Natural History Museum.
Is that what you call it?
Yeah, the Natch. It's the best museum, I think. And I really imagine, to me, in New York. I mean, I love the Noguchi Museum. It's just so awesome. Ever since I was a kid, I probably went there once a month for 20 years. And it's just such a great museum. And I always picture MoFad being a little bit like that one day.
Definitely. My goal is to be the best field trip in the city. I think, hands down, we can win that.
So how do you see it? I mean, this is way down the line, and no one's even talked about it within the inner circle, I think, because it is so far down the line. But just to put you on the spot, like, tell us, how do you see that museum? What do you think it will look like in 5 years? Like, someone pays their ticket, they walk through, and what are they going to see?
I think they're going to see whatever topic we pick. So we take something like coffee, say, and that's the exhibit for the next few months. I think it's really important to stress that we want to be a 21st century museum. We don't want to be like, you know, the AMNH is great. The American Museum of Natural History is awesome. But, you know, if you've been one time, the dioramas aren't really going to change the next time you go. And they only have several, like only a couple like rotating exhibits. We would have like no real permanent exhibit. We would
I disagree with that. Yeah. And
really?
I've told Dave, I think the museum equals permanency.
Yeah.
It's an archive, you know, and there's certain
food is not permanent.
Well, that's true. But, you know, I was thinking, for instance, we had talked about, you know, collecting all the knives, one knife from every chef in New York. That can be permanent. Say in 2015, here are 12,000 knives. This was the names of every chef. Also, Dave's idea of, you know, the history of cereal boxes.
Yeah.
You know, I think permanent exhibit has the very high expectation that it has to be so great that it can, you know, people do want to come. But in the Natural History Museum, for instance, that elephant room, I mean, is still fun, you know? So it has to be awesome. I think it has to almost be moving like a distillery or something like that. But, I mean, I think permanency provides, you know, I don't know, favorite spots.
It gives a good foundation. And permanency in terms of the museum could mean sort of, you know, not what's going on right now in the New York City culinary world, but, like, what, you know, the grassroots of the South and just the entire, you know, the global sort of foundations of food in general, and have that be more of the exhibit end of it. And then also the rotating stuff would be, you know, the amazing coffee movement that's going on right now in the U.S. with all the different sort of procurement and smaller sort of companies that are rising up. But yeah, you're 100% right. You need, you
know, a collection of farm tools or tractors.
Yeah, I think a permanent collection definitely like makes a museum. Like, we definitely want to be a house for things like that. Like, I don't want to see, you know, like the equipment that my great grandparents used on their farm in Pennsylvania. Like, I wouldn't want to see that just go away because somebody thought it was junk. But to have like a place where that can be housed forever and ever, that definitely makes a museum a museum.
Or, you know, a middle class dining room throughout history. From Rome, what would it have looked like? Where would the people be sitting? I mean, that sounds, people, once they come once. But remember, little kids are the ones that always go to things many times, like movies or whatever. They'll see the Smurfs 15 times. It's a very interesting thing. I mean, the people talk passionately about, like, what is part of
and
a
many,
museum.
Many
oh,
meetings,
yeah.
Many meetings you'll have over the next
few years. Definitely.
And a lot of opinions. I mean,
and it's
and
an interesting time in for museums in general, because this is the kind of conversation that happens all the time. And then, of course, like, something as passion-driven as food is something that, like, everyone has, you know, an opinion about, and so many people have great educated opinions about. We could go on forever.
So how do people participate, you know, with their stuff, with their money, with their time? I mean, I know you're just in your early stages of creating, like, membership tiers, but, you know, just talk about how, you know, people can help in this prenatal stage almost of the museum's history.
Yeah, it's, you can get involved in different ways. You know, we can certainly take, if you have, like, a great menu collection, cookbook collection, pharma collection, you know, just sort of get in touch with me. Don't send it to to my house, but email me at info.
This is a pair of James Beard's underwear. Those skid marks are oysters.
The first ever rib. First ever rib roast cooked by Julia Child.
But you can get me at info@mofad.org. Mm-hmm. Or Sarah, Sarah, at mofad.org. And, you know, like, let me know what you have. Let me know if you have something that, you know, your antique dish towels or this really awesome Wheaties box from 1984. And,
Mary Lou
Retton. Yeah, I had that haircut.
Oh, really?
But, yeah, like, you know, get in touch and let's talk about how we can, you know, put that and make that part of the museum.
So it's specifically U.S.? The United States, or
yeah, or is it going to be global? That's
then
a good
it's a
question.
Whole nother. I mean, there's a whole nother financing, and then there's a whole nother.
I think the interest is probably largely American, because in Europe, food museums are very common. In
really?
France, I think every food has a museum. So it's like, so, you know, here we're sort of the exception, and so I think that, you know, it'll be something that, you know, when it is standing, you know, all the foreign tourists that are coming through New York City are going to be like, of course, food museum, I want to go in there. And then I really don't want to insult somebody's, like, cheese from their homeland by inaccurately portraying it in my museum. But
do you have a, I mean, you've been talking about this a while, but do you have a specific time you would start in the U.S.? Would it be, you know, sort of when the Mayflower, you know, like, was there specific
time when you can
when
go so far back? I mean, like, I would love to get even pre, like, Jamestown, Virginia times, like, you know, like the early, I mean, as far back as we can go. Although, I guess, like,
I have a diorama I want for that. All those Jamestown guys that starved to death, why didn't they fish?
This is right, isn't
They're
it weird?
Right on the
There's
Atlantic.
So much. There was so much food there at that time. I guess I just didn't know
how to do it. I mean, they James must have River, not been the smartest people.
They didn't send out
people.
The sharpest, sharpest pencils out there on that.
They just and they wound up.
It was
just
an experimental kind of thing. It's just sort of send these guys out on the boat.
And they did. They did wind up like eating each other.
It wasn't
like,
Colin
it didn't
Farrell.
Sound,
let's just say that.
Yeah, it was not Colin Farrell. It did sound pretty horrible, actually. But
man.
But you know, like going even dialing it back a little bit further from that, you know, and I think like this is where the argument about like having a permanent exhibit versus all temporary exhibits come in, because it's like, even just in our, you know, very young nation, yeah. You know, we could go on and on and on if we started talking about food just from 1950 to 1980, or if we just start talking about, you know, the pre-Revolutionary War food. It's just, you could go on and on and on. But yeah, I think we'd like to go and definitely cover all of.
Yeah, you need a core structure in the museum to lean on, to give you 2 or 3 weeks till your new exhibit comes there from a operations financial perspective. So you need to lean on something just to give people to look at in terms of if you have the sort of 1950s sort of post-World War II commodity sort of world coming up exhibit, which I'd like to curate, by the way. Just kidding. But totally. So
I think there's big stuff. There's like grain. Yeah. Grain, that's a big universal topic that, you know, could be global in scale, and you talk about grain, and that goes all the way to distilling spirits, you know, just the
what
grain
happened?
You know, I think
and even it's interesting that you bring up grain, because there's even like the when you talk about globally, it's like even if you just talk about like say Thomas Jefferson, who went like in Italy and then started pocketing grain and bringing it back here, or like when we, you know, like that whole like how we were able to sort of survive and write out different famine.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, just revisiting history through the lens of these things is very interesting.
Exactly.
Because, you know, a grain exhibit could have a diorama on Thomas Jefferson, and it's that information on that little sheet, you know, that there that glows in the dark for nighttime, you know, when you read all about whatever that, why that diorama was chosen. I mean, it's really fascinating because it's a way to reorganize history, basically, through the lens of these topics.
And through an accessible point, you know, like everyone eats. So
yeah,
everyone has
everywhere.
Yeah.
Is there something that you found after sort of getting into this project that is really interesting about the U.S. food world that you just found out that you never knew before?
It was actually that Thomas Jefferson thing.
I thought you were going to say you couldn't believe Heritage was run out of such a shithole. That was your biggest.
I was really excited about the dogs.
That's a 718.
Sarah does work part time.
I mean,
you know, when she works for MOFAD, she works out of Heritage. This is a temporary. We love having her. But,
and they are very generous to have me there, and it is, and it's great, and I love the dogs.
You're always yelling at people on the phone. You're like 50,000. How dare you?
I need money. I need real money. And speaking of which, and soon we'll be able to offer a really exclusive lifetime membership package that we're working on.
So it's like a deal if you support
it's
early?
It's like an annuity.
Right, exactly. It's like you're going to be able to buy in now and then become a lifetime member. Like, you know, you are one of the original supporters of the museum and, you know, we're going to definitely like lay out the red carpet for those people that want to join up and want to be on board this early on. But I think we're only going to offer 500 of those, and it's going to be $1,000 level, but you'll get a private dinners with the guys that are, you know, in on this from the beginning, like
and
David
you won't
Chang,
be
like Dufresne.
You won't be annoyed that you made that decision until the first 400 people that walk into the museum are all like, oh, I'm back from 2011. They're like, get in.
Yeah, because museum memberships can hold a lot. I had a similar experience working at a museum and really like selling the membership and then getting the visitor center people to come up to me and be like, listen, no one is paying coming through the door because you are selling this membership.
You spent their money 4 years ago.
It's the U.S., it's like the U.S. government.
Also, my big thing is about like letting kids under a certain age come. It shouldn't be divided by age. It should be a height thing. If they're below a certain thing, like the roller coasters, I think that'll
what about
really
all
attract
the poor,
people.
Really
and that ties into nutrition.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You're not healthy enough.
Kid, go back, eat some more, and
get
maybe you
stronger.
Can get into this museum that involves food.
Oh, brother. Well, it's very exciting. So the email is probably the best way for people to get in touch with you and learn more, and then you'll send them more information.
Absolutely.
So
you know,
that's
info@mofad.org or sarah@mofad.org if you're feeling more personal.
And you're looking for anything, ideas, questions.
Know, yeah, tell me what you want to hear, what you want to see in a museum. Tell me about like what you have to offer for a collection, a curating idea, and if you have a blank check in your apartment for $100 million...
And this is
definitely
your,
call me.
I would buy another 3 months of work.
This is your thing?
This is Dave.
Dave Arnold.
I have been enlisted and brainwashed and set
forth. She's the number one. She's like, you know, as close to an executive director as you can get, you know.
So, you know, everyone take that into consideration.
Yes, feel free to suck up to me now to get into the grain exhibit later.
If you want to get your knife into the Patrick Martin's exhibit of chefs.
It would be a nice, friendly, a knife show for kids.
Well, it was funny you said that. I said, when you said that, I said, oh, that's already happened. It was called the Kobe Club.
The Kobe Club?
You know, Patrick, this is Jack. When I DJ, we go by knife show.
Really?
How about that?
Can you bring us out with a knife show?
Being sued by my own executive producer. Oh, man. No, I'm sorry, Jack. That is, Knife Show is very good DJing. What do you call yourselves? Groups nowadays?
Sure, yeah. DJ group.
Well, this is an interesting show. I love Shane's energy. I love learning about distribution and island culture. Jessica Applestone and Joshua Applestone, I mean, they're really on the tippity top of the butcher pyramid in America.
Yeah.
And I loved it. We were like, what does it mean that bellies aren't traded in the commodity market? And we're all like, I don't really know what that means. Because none of us are on it. But and then Sarah Pollock, you know, the very inspiring, very far away. You know, it's hard. It's almost like waiting for Halley's Comet to come back. It's a long ways away, but it's still very impressive. I mean, when this museum does hit, it's going to be a global force for sure. And we're going to do, Jason, a whole month together in August.
I'm really excited about it.
Chris
Baer
from Brooklyn Larder, used to be at A16.
I have a few guests that we're talking about. We'll have our meeting next week. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about August. I will, you know, be eliminating the beach for the entire month of August for the show.
For your name, for your fame.
For my fame. But I did want to mention that I will be judging a meatball competition next week at Bruce Hanaway's house, 18 Gotham. And down there in Breezy Point. I just wanted to bring that up. I had to throw that in there.
A meatball competition? That's the food, not stupid guys, right?
Well, yes. Ties back into Staten Island a little bit. That's more meathead.
Meathead.
Yes,
meathead. My Uncle Ronaldo always used to call me a meatball. I always loved it. That was still used as a kind of semi-curse word. Anyway, great show. We've been engineered by Jack Inslee and produced by him as well. And we will be back next week, where we're going to be talking about butcher guilds.
Perfect.
Once was the ride when we were at our high, waiting for you in the hotel at night. I knew I had him at my match, but every moment we get snatched. I don't know why I got.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. A new film is coming out. It's called American Meat. It's a documentary based on the life of Joel Salatin of Polyface Farms. But it also includes footage from conventional livestock agriculture and processing plants. So you do get a bit more of a less biased, shall we say, view of how livestock agriculture works. It makes many of the same arguments, of course, as you would have seen in Food Inc., so there's nothing especially groundbreaking here, but in this case, the producers claim to be free of a quote-unquote agenda. If you didn't get enough information from Food Inc., look for this one. Again, it's called American Meat. The website gives no release date, but you can learn a little bit more by Googling just American Meat. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Whole Foods Market is a proud partner of Edible Manhattan, Edible East End, and Edible Brooklyn. Join us this summer in celebrating good beer with the Edible Team's July 26th event at Brooklyn Academy of Music. Come taste and sip as we pair our favorite selection of pickles and cheeses with Sierra Nevada. Visit www.wholefoodsmarket.com/Bowery for more information.